This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hong, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you guys doing this evening?
Good. Excellent.
Pretty good. How are you, Nate?
I'm doing good. I wanted to just make a short announcement for some of the listeners. I just wanted to really say thank you. I had mentioned a few episodes in a row that I had got some nasty emails, and I had a whole bunch of people email me some praise and for Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, you, and the podcast itself. So I just wanted to reach out and say thank you to those listeners. I really appreciate it. Made my week.
Oh, that's Excellent. Really nice.
That's good.
Always good to hear that we're not offending everybody.
There you go.
In fact, it reminded me of a lecture, Dr. Lyle, that you gave one time where you drew a bell curve and you said, because there was one question in one of the audience that said, why do I keep offending people? You know, this wasn't my question. Somebody asked you, Dr. Lyle, why do I keep offending people at lunch? Nobody wants to talk politics with me. And you drew a bell curve and you said, well, anytime you take one position, it's just like there's enough people, there's going to be somebody on the complete opposite end. So mm-hmm. be careful what you say at lunch.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There you go. Yes. Good advice.
This is very much, you know, you're offending some of the people all of the time or all of the people some of the time. And so we just kind of have to strike the right balance. But we're always just trying to tell the truth. That's all we're up to.
Yeah. See if we'll just see how many people we can offend today. We'll just find out.
That's right. Let's make that a goal. Yeah.
Hey, maybe one day there'll be like a little ticker, you know, and it'll be like a little competitive.
All right.
Well, so then we'll have a good truth to offense ratio.
Good. There you go.
So, So today we're talking a little bit more about coronavirus and mm-hmm. this pandemic going on, and then mm-hmm. also some coronavirus related questions of how people are dealing with this pandemic and any stay at home orders, et cetera. So, but before we start, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, do you have any updates for us about any new data that has come out that you wanted to share with us or anything in that topic?
Well, I certainly would, but I want to give Jen the floor, because once I rev up, it might be a while.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I don't think there's anything anything new that we would want to share would be, you know, in watching the numbers, which I know that you've been doing. So I don't think I have any brand new observations on the social end of things. I have sort of ongoing observations, but nothing that is a burning topic that needs to be addressed. I put myself in the position of saying, well, we want to get ourselves sort of grounded in the new data first before we move forward. But then, you know, 45 minutes later, we'll see where we are. So I yield the floor with some trepidation, but great optimism that we'll get where we're supposed to be going eventually.
Well,
I love
good.
It.
Now, I've been silent long enough. It's been.
That's right. I know it's really difficult.
Yeah, I think a great deal has come to light in the last week, and so the last week has been an important week for our understanding. And so a few things happened that were important. One thing that was important was our friend Ioannidis at Stanford. He and his crew went out to gather data in California, in the Bay Area, and by doing testing on antibodies. And as best they can determine, around 3% or so of the San Francisco Bay Area was infected. and which means they were infected and never knew it and had some mild symptoms and then passed on. They also then turned around and ran that same, another group ran the same study in Southern California and LA area, came back, I think, with somewhat higher numbers, but more or less, you know, triangulating on something between 3%, 4%, 5% of people were infected as of probably April 1st. So that from there, that tells you that California very likely has seen 3% or 4% of its population infected of, you know, 40 something million people. So you're looking at just grossly maybe 1.5 million infections, and you have about 1,200 fatalities. So it that is looking like 0.1 in California at this moment. The Ioannidis says, okay, looks like the flu, similar ballpark to the flu. And so that's a huge thing. Incidentally, an entertaining side effect of this, I don't know, you may remember the guy's name, Jen, the political science guy in at Columbia.
Hellman, God, what is his name? It's Andrew something. Gelman, maybe?
Yeah.
I believe it's Andrew Gelman. He's been sort of a stats adjacent poli-sci guy for a long time. Let me just, I'll confirm while you're describing him, but I'm pretty sure it's Andrew Gelman.
Yeah, apparently he was all upset at this.
Yeah, well, he doesn't like good news.
right. So we wouldn't want to hear any good news.
No.
Just when our big funding check was going to come, right when we really needed it to be a big disaster. If anybody starts indicating it's not, then this is bad. This is terrible. And he called out the Stanford group and said that they should apologize to Stanford University. This is terrible.
To the university, to the statistics community more
community.
Broadly.
Yeah. Yeah, just we're talking about one of the greatest statistical scientists in medicine of all time here that he is criticizing. So he's way out of line, like a typical, you know, he obviously he has politicized, not just politics politicized, but personal competitive agendas that you will not see in Ioannidis at all. So
yeah,
when you listen
He's really made his career on sort of, you know, talking about political polarization and, you know, why rich people vote differently than poor people. And so he's a political scientist with a particular political agenda. And I think he's a fairly well-regarded statistician, and he's especially in Bayesian methods. But he's not a fan of good news when research
doesn't
money's
want
riding
this
on the
good
line.
News.
Yeah.
So this was extraordinarily important good news, and it certainly. There's certainly more to be learned about it, and when you look at numbers like this, essentially pointing to a death rate of 1 in 1,000. When I look at the stats from New York, and in New York they already have something like 20,000 fatalities, and they only have 20 million people, so they're already at 1 in 1,000. So it gives me pause that it could be as good as 1 in 1,000. It could be. Could be double that, and very, very possibly is double that. There's New York City. I've had a number of listeners that are a bunch of sharp people send me a lot of good stuff over the last week. So somebody sent me something about New York being the most potentially vulnerable city by essentially how old folks are. A lot of folks sent me the Ioannidis research and other research. And so it looks, there was an Oxford group that has done, you know, has basically ground huge amounts of numbers, and everything in their database was triangulating for things to probably be south of 0.2. So again, to use the numbers the way Jen would like us to use the numbers, 0.2% would be that if you were infected on average, you have a 99.8% of survival. If it's a 0.1 or 1 in 1,000 fatality, you would have a 99.9% chance of survival. So either way, either of these numbers, whether we're now the debate, the legitimate debate now starts at 0.1, 0.2, maybe 0.3. 1.0 is out. And the World Health Organization discussion about this being 2%, 3%, 2.7%, 1.7%, these are all, as Ioannidis says, these are astronomical mistakes. They're not even close. And so what we're dealing with is we're now dealing with what appears to be in the United States, it would look like we are past the midpoint and we are on the downslope. So we have now had, according to the University of Washington model, we're probably three quarters of the way through the fatalities that we're going to experience. We probably had, at least two thirds of them, or if not three quarters of them. So that's still a lot of fatalities. Clearly, a nasty new virus on the scene. Once again, though, when we look at who the victims are, this is important for all of us to understand who the victims are, so that we understand really what the true cost is of this disease. So this is not to minimize; this is to be accurate as to what the true costs are. Also, I've had a number of people talk to me this week that are legitimately worried themselves because they can't make heads or tails of the all of the news and the numbers. And you should understand that according to this evidence, if you're reasonably healthy at any age, reasonably healthy, you don't have to be like a picture of health, just reasonably healthy, your odds of a fatality of this are extremely low. This is particularly true for anybody who's around 60 or younger. These odds start to be in the neighborhood of less than your risk this year of dying in an auto accident. So if you're under 50, if you're 50-ish or under, it is considerably less odds than you dying in an auto accident. So hopefully that, that's just this year. I mean, your odds of dying in an auto accident lifetime are massively higher than your odds of dying of the coronavirus. So let's keep in context as to what the risk factors are. They are lower than you driving. Okay? So let's keep that straight. And it's not a matter of whether or not your unlucky number comes up. This is if you're infected. If you are infected with the coronavirus, your odds of dying of the coronavirus are a lot less than you dying in an auto accident this year. Okay? So that's something to keep in mind. So the another way to look at this, and then we'll table this and go to other issues. But a way to look at this is to step back and look at the total social, total biological cost of this virus, and in context to other biological costs that we face. So, for example, so the virus doesn't even come close to the cost of possible fatalities with driving. So that's not even so the total amount of fatalities that could take place from this virus over the next 30 years, are not going to come into the ballpark with how many people would die of fatalities on the road. Particularly when we multiply that by the amount of number of years lost. Because the average person who dies on the road might be 40 years old, but the average person that dies of this virus is in their 70s. So there's a huge difference in the amount of life lost. So if we were going to look at the cost of this whole thing, and right now if we were to take as an estimate, probably the worst case scenario estimate right now is that it's a 0.2% fatality. In other words, 99.8% chance of survival. If you're infected, the truth is that obscures some very important distinctions, and that is that if you're over 70, it's probably more like 1%, and if you're 50 or 40, it's going to be like 1 in 10,000. So the people that are 65 and over are overwhelmingly overrepresented here. And the people as age climbs, 75 is way more problematic than 65, and 80 is more problematic than 75, and 85 is much more problematic than 80. In other words, this is a heavily age-correlated disease. So that means that the amount of life lost, and remember that if you're 75 years old and you contract this virus, there's a 99% chance that you survive it. So who is the 1% that doesn't survive? That's not a random individual, folks. Remember that, you know, 10% or so people of that age are smoking. An awful lot of people of that age have stents in their heart. Many of them have multiple pathological conditions that they are in trouble. They're medicated for a variety of ills. Diabetes is very significant. So when we look, add up all of the, and incidentally, the evidence very clearly implicates these things as major additive factors to the likelihood of death. So as a result, we know that if a person is a 1 out of 100 who dies of an infection of this virus in their old age, they are not a random individual. They are absolutely, they're not even close to a random individual. They're clearly in the bottom 10 percentile, not 100% of the time, but they are very, very statistically likely to be in the bottom 10 percentile for life expectancy. So the way to think about this is if the average age of the average death of the coronavirus in the United States is maybe 75, it's 80 in Italy. So if it's about 75, then, and mostly male, 60-40, the average male just in general at 75 years old may have a life expectancy of, you know, 7 years. The person that is in the bottom 10 percentile of that life expectancy is probably half of that. So if we actually look at the life expectancy of the typical individual that dies from the coronavirus, it's probably no more than 5 years. 5 years is probably very generous. So if we were to look at that and we were to say, okay, let's suppose that the coronavirus has a cost, if you are an individual victim, of 60 months. I think that's probably very reasonable. And we believe that your odds of being such a victim are maybe 1%. So we're going to divide 60 months by 100. And we're going to find out the per capita cost for these older individuals. And we're going to wind up with less than a month. So the cost, and this is of our older individuals, if you divide it now by the entire population, it's going to be very small. So we're talking days. Now, contrast this, for example, as a public health issue, how many days of life are lost per capita to the coronavirus? We're going to find out that it's a handful of days as we spread it out over the population. This is assuming that everybody in the population would ultimately contract the virus, and that there would never be herd immunity, and that there would never be any a vaccine or anything else under the sun. So this is assuming that 350 million people, all of them sooner or later get the coronavirus, and in their old age, if they get it, that they a certain percentage wind up succumbing. So that's how we would run that data. Now contrast that with, so we have essentially 2 in 1,000 people will die, and of those people, we have an average cost of maybe 5 years. Okay, so that's one in 500 times 5 years. That's one way to think about this. Now let's contrast this with another public health cost, and we're going to contrast this with cigarette smoking. So cigarette smoking is 14% of the population. And of those people, that will cost them about 8 to 10 years. So it's probably close to twice as costly in terms of years. And it's 70 times more prevalent. So therefore, what we're talking about is we're talking about a social cost that is like 140 to 1 in terms of the days lost. So when we really look at this, now some people might say, yeah, but it's got this capricious aspect that you catch this thing and then you die and it just doesn't seem fair because it was pushed upon you by the environment. And I can understand that. And I mean, that has us all rattled and it has us all feeling like, you know, we're sort of spinning the wheel of fortune and we don't want to be on the wrong side of it. And it feels, you know, we all feel threatened. And I understand that. But the truth of the matter is that number one, the overall costs are low et cetera. And also, it's also the case that a substantial amount of the costs of coronavirus are self-inflicted in the same way that the cigarette smoking is. So, of course, we also understand that people don't sort of know what they're doing and they don't know about diet and lifestyle, et cetera. But they certainly know about cigarette smoking. They also don't know how to manage their diet and lifestyle issues generally very well. But so there are costs there that are being imposed on people really out of ignorance. But when we look at the total costs here, I think we should keep these in mind, particularly, I mean, I don't know that anybody is. But when we really look at the total societal costs and biological costs of individuals, the problem of, and I'm no big anti-smoking person, it's like if you want to smoke, go ahead. But literally the cost of secondhand smoke to secondary individuals and environments is considerably greater than the sum total cost of the coronavirus. So this is the context that I think is useful for people to keep in mind. When you're staring out there now, listening to the news bombard you with the horrendous fear and essentially the never-ending bad news, and you look at the very substantial economic carnage that is resulting from this, back up and realize that this whole thing is 1/100th of the biological tragedy and costs associated with cigarette smoking in this country. Okay, so now we start thinking of, is there anything that we could do as a society that might reduce cigarette smoking by 1%? Because if it was, it would counterbalance the effect of the coronavirus. So that's my rant for the day. And now
that has very interesting implications of that thought experiment, Dr. Lyle.
Yeah. Oh, well, nobody cares.
Yeah.
but I do. Go ahead.
I mean, it's a very like rational approach, very, very mathematically grounded. Like, of course it makes all kinds of intellectual sense when you look at it this way, but this is not what people's lived experience is, because people are, you know, they're not irrational in the sense that their minds are coming up with ideas and assessments and inferences and cost-benefit analyses that are coming out of nowhere. All of those inferences and cost-benefit analyses are coming from distorted information, i.e. outliers being overrepresented in the media. You know, the friend of the friend who went into the hospital feeling a little sick and didn't make it. And people's personality distortion, people just being more sort of a little more emotionally volatile, a little more conscientious. Also the immersive existential experience of going out into the world, and everybody's now required, at least in Sonoma County and lots of places around the country now, it's mandatory that you wear a mask in public. And so this is like an unprecedented sort of existential thing that is getting into people's, it's tapping into whatever sort of baseline irrationality they have, combined with the bad information that they're getting from a very distorted information media environment, social media, CNN, wherever it's coming from. It's overrepresenting outliers, and it's designed to scare you so it keeps your eyeballs glued on the page. It's just absolutely how it works. And so it's people need, I know it feels like you're doing the wrong thing to turn away from the information, to turn off the TV, to shut down the social media feed, because you have this, we've talked about this before, where it's information is so salient and important in the Stone Age. If you've got a little bit of an advantage, you know how something works a little better than the other guy, this not only speaks volumes to your survival and reproduction capacity, but your entire village, and you may be greatly celebrated for bringing this new information back home. So we have this like inability to detach from the influx of information, much of which is bad, distorted, skewed, biased, and it is having a very direct effect on how we are going about our lives in the midst of this, and we don't have a lot of so-called rational control over that process. So it feels like you are doing the wrong thing by detaching, by turning off the news, but you that is the only part of your environment that you can control. There's no piece of information that you're getting from watching overrepresentation of outliers that's going to contribute to your ability to survive this thing in any sort of measurable way. There's nothing that you need to know at this point that's going to change your behavior and give you better survival odds against this terrible menace. And so the only thing that's happening by being tuned into constant bombardment of news is that you're making yourself crazy. You're making yourself crazy, and you're sort of contributing to ongoing distorted inferences about it. So it's really important for people, if they find themselves really bothered by this and really stressed out, to just turn off the news, just turn away, just stop talking about it constantly, stop freaking out about it with the additional pieces of information that you're getting. I realize there's some irony in saying this on a podcast about the coronavirus that anybody who is listening to, I'm effectively telling you to tune out right now. But it really is like you can't recognize the degree to which this is.
You guys are actually giving us the accurate information,
right?
Now, so.
Yes, yeah. But it's like pleasure trap.
Sometimes
food.
You can't tell. Yeah, yeah. Like we were talking about this the other day, Dr. Hawk, this is like an intellectual pleasure trap.
It is.
You know, the right thing feels wrong and the wrong thing feels right.
Yes.
It sounds familiar, Dr. Lyle, from your pleasure trap TED Talk.
Yeah, yeah. And there's so many people, especially highly conscientious people, which are very well represented in our listener population, who really struggle with like, oh, I can't possibly not be up on the latest. I've got to have the latest numbers. I've got to know all the latest information. And so they just put themselves in this position where they can't normally calibrate. They're permanently being distorted by an information environment over which they have zero control. And it's really, it's causing a lot of distress to a lot of people. So
It sounds to me, and maybe Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, you can you know tell me if I'm incorrectly assessing this, but the people who are really reacting this way are just in general very opportunistic, and they're fierce competitors when it comes to normal life, and so this is an opportunity to really really kind of showcase the personality traits that make them do this.
There's a lot of that, you know, extreme, you know, the sort of some of the loudest voices are the most disagreeable, conscientious people I know. So you get somebody who's very disagreeable and very conscientious, and they are, you know, really like a big voice for this issue, and they really want to make the case and talk about it all the time and highlight how destructive it is and how problematic it is and how we're all doomed, it's terrible, we're doomed. So you're running into that a lot. But I think also just people are sort of mostly conscientious and maybe a little, you know, they're not super stable. That doesn't mean they're unstable. They might just be average emotional stability. Average emotional stability is going to be rocked by this situation. You can't go to the post office without putting a mask on your face and watching everybody else. And, you know, everybody's behind plastic. And this is, you would have to be an extremely stable character to not be bothered by that. So there's nothing about your personality that says that you're wildly unstable if you're disturbed by the changing value proposition of a world that you've never seen before. That's absolutely appropriate that you would have some reaction to that. And so most people are having a reaction to that. So it becomes necessary when you're looking at that kind of situation and it's causing you a lot of emotional distress. It's like, well, what can I do about it? What you can do about it is you can control your environment, because you can't change who you are. And you can't change the fact that all of these purveyors of information are extremely incentivized to scare the crap out of you. And then information entrepreneurs like you're describing, Nathan, who are disagreeable, conscientious, who are even more incentivized by virtue of their sort of disagreeable, pushy personality. So it's all the only leverage that you have over your life experience right now is to control your immediate environment and turn off your TV.
Yeah, unless it's Ioannidis, then you listen.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead, Nathan.
Oh, so speaking of which, is one comment that I got from a listener recently was the following. Dear doctors, people on social media are using your analysis of the COVID-19 data to justify defiance of mitigation measures, holding protests, reopening the economy. What say you? You know,
Well, first of all, that's ludicrous because nobody's listening to me and then going and protesting. We have a tiny little group of an intellectual elite group of people that isn't doing anything of the kind. Okay, so that person's just setting up a straw argument to try to ding us a little bit. The truth is that all we're trying to do is speak to people's IQ. And to get them to try to help them actually analyze the real CB that's out there in the world, which is important. And I think we emphasized that, you know, a month ago, it was very uncertain what we were looking at. It was pretty uncertain, you know, uncertain enough to me even a week ago, even though the curves looked awfully good. They looked, in other words, it looked an awful lot more like a tenth of a percent than it looked like a percent. And so the catastrophic version was starting to fail as a model with respect to the collected evidence. And so now that is now more firmly established, despite the nut from Columbia throwing a fit. But the truth of the matter is, good.
Go, you know what I mean? So,
right. But the thing is that where this started was the following, perfectly reasonably. And that is, early in the game, you don't know what it is. It just looks scary and bad, and it's a very nasty illness, and it kills people, and it kills them brutally. So right away, you've got everybody super worried. And so the first thing you have to do is you have to say, whoa, if this is a 1%, this is a catastrophe. And so what do? So now you go overboard. And you do what it is that we've done and other countries have done. And in the meantime, you know that even if it's a tenth as bad or two tenths as bad as you're deeply fearing, it's going to be bad enough to overwhelm systems, health systems in certain places where there's going to be a resource management crisis and people are going to die that didn't need to die because we didn't have enough ventilators or beds or doctors or whatever the thing was. And so it makes sense in that regard to actually work in the flatten the curve theory. Flatten the curve theory with respect to stopping a virus in its tracks may or may not be long-term particularly useful. It might if you get a vaccine at some point. But it certainly makes a lot of sense with respect to resource management crisis. But now I think we can see, now in later April, the resource management crisis I don't believe exists in the United States. In other words, I think the actions of the last several weeks have actually hit that thing head on and very intelligently. I don't know how intelligently. An awful lot of brains have been working on that problem. And there's been, I'm sure, you know, huge overkill in all kinds of places. More ventilators. Ford Motor Company is going to make 100,000 more than we need. And, you know, all this sort of thing. But that's fine. It's like we didn't know what we were up against. So why not go for broke? And make sure that we can
we're
do everything to not get... What's that?
So we're the king of ventilators now.
Yeah. So now we're the king of ventilators. That's fine. Okay. So that's just an expense of facing a crisis and not having the parameters figured out. And so such is life. And now we can all be deeply relieved that this thing is an intermediate level problem. And that's what it is. And, you know, with an intermediate level costs is all that's necessary. Now we're going to get all kinds of, now it becomes a political resource management football that we're going to watch now for the next few months all about that. But I was not down on at all and trying to minimize what was reasonable to do. But now we have a different issue. So now the public does not understand what we're talking about here. Public doesn't understand that this is 1% of the public health threat of cigarette smoking. They don't know this. They don't know anything close to this. They don't understand that the risk here is less than their odds of dying in a car crash, which is not something they think about other than doing what? Than putting on their seatbelt and hopefully driving a safe car and not driving drunk. So, in other words, be reasonable, be smart, be prudent, and then the right thing to do is understand that the problems are overwhelmingly concentrated in the elderly and the ill elderly. So it makes sense as a society to think through and have expert advice as to how it is that we can close off or reduce the exposure of those people to this threat, but not everybody else. We know that 3 or 4% of the state of California has been exposed in the last 30 days. We've got 1.5 million people that don't even know they even had it. Okay? So if that's what the situation is, and that when the virus gets to an elderly sick person, it creates an early and unfortunate death, then obviously the thing to do is to protect them and otherwise, you know, not worry about it. Any more than you'd worry about any other, you know, any reasonable amount of worry. So we're not looking to have people protest. We're looking for intelligent discussion about this. Incidentally, I'm actually not obsessed with this. I think it's a fascinating and serious problem. And obviously it warranted, you know, very high level attention here the last month. I read something in a major outlet. I can't remember what it was, Atlantic or New York Times, or I can't remember what it was, but it was the author was complaining about anybody that says that these people would have died anyway, and they said, well, listen, you could look at the data and it shows that this month, you know, there's 30,000 more deaths than they were this time last year. So therefore, these are additive. And if you look in Sweden, it's 6,000 more, whatever it is. And they said, so you see, these are extra deaths. These are not these people would not have died anyway. Well, that is moronic analysis. And I wish I could take the 130 IQ human being that went to Swarthmore and then wrote that article for that outlet and take him out to the woodshed. And I don't know, they need to be slapped around. They need to use their brain because nobody said that they were going to die today or this month. What we said is that they are, those individuals are in trouble and that their length of life is not the same thing as an average member of the population. So the thing to do to actually analyze the net effect of the coronavirus is going to be to watch the death rates over the next 2 or 3 years. That's what we're going to be looking at, okay? So when the death rates go up this year by 60 or 70 or 80,000 people, the question is, do they go down next year by 20,000? That's what you need to be looking at, okay? Once the virus has passed, which it probably will pass and go quiet for the remainder of the year, it may or may not, but let's suppose that it does. Then what we're going to be looking at is we're going to be looking at October, November, December, January. We're going to be seeing whether or not it's 3,000 a month less in the upcoming months because of the 70,000 people that we lose here this spring. But I will believe that some of those people wouldn't have made it over this next couple of years. In fact, probably a good percentage. So, of course, the data doesn't indicate it now because it can't. So hopefully anybody that was, so don't be intimidated by that argument, because that's a fallacious and you know, abhorrent statistical analysis. You, of course, are looking at that these individuals, of course, we are saying, yes, they are people that are in trouble and their lives are expected to be relatively short. Of course, the virus is taking some of the last of their precious life, but they are individuals that we can look at this total cost in this way that I'm describing, not by looking at the score this month. Look at the score this month. There's no way to analyze the total cost here.
That's wonderful. Dr. Lau, whenever you like explain these types of things, and I can hear your voice in the background where you're like, all right, let's back up the camera and take a wide angle look at this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's going to be actually quite obvious. So we will, but we won't know that story very well, you know, for the next year or two. But, you know, 2 years from now, we'll be able to look back much more accurately and look at the cost. And, you know, it's going to be something like we're describing.
Yeah. But when you're in the middle of a resource management surge, like we are, there's no intuition in most people that it's a bell curve and that it will ever diminish in its sort of pace.
Right.
You just sort of imagine that what you're looking at now is what you are going to project indefinitely into the future. And that's a very alarming thing to think about. And so then you do start thinking, oh, well, it is, people are dying who wouldn't have otherwise died. And it's, if it's your grandma, it's like, oh, well, you have this kind of bias that, I could have had another 10, 20 years with her, but that's just statistically not the case. It may be the case for your specific grandma. Of course, there are always there's variation in the data and there are lots of outliers. But overall, with the whole data pattern, you are looking at people who are, in the last 6 months to 2 years of their life. And so, yes, they're being punished earlier by this thing and at a faster rate that is overwhelming certain systems in certain places. But it's not, this is something that does rebalance itself over time. So the long-term data will tell the tale, which will be something to watch. This is actually something that's come up with the, there have been a lot of memes going around about the mass graves. So a lot of people are saying, oh, well, this is particularly in New York. This is, you know, we've never had mass graves before. And this is proof that this is this, unbelievable, terrible thing. And it's never going to end. Well, mass graves have always existed for unidentified, unclaimed bodies. And they're usually these people are buried with the idea that it's temporary and that hopefully they will be claimed and reinterred somewhere else. And so there's been more demand on those mass grave centers than normal, because there is more resource use and overwhelm in New York in particular. But the concept we haven't built trenches for mass graves as a society in a way that we never have before. So this is the little nuances of information in the environment that really get to people and tap into like their greatest fears and the greatest unknowns, and all of the kind of disgust mechanisms and in-group out-group mechanisms that accompany something like a invisible scary virus, lead people into inferences that are really self-destructive and contributing to great unhappiness.
Yeah.
Oh, it's enough to make someone traumatized. Just kidding. So
go ahead,
Dr. Lau. I've learned to never interrupt you.
Just go right ahead. Yeah, what's up?
Well, it's one of the questions from a listener is about these I'm so traumatized memes floating around on social media because of this lockdown. So if you want, Dr. Lau, do you want to say what you wanted to say and then we can do that question?
Oh no. The I don't know that this is something that I guess I don't have good intuition about this, just because I don't, as someone who's actually quite emotionally stable, you know, probably 90th percentile on a typical Big Five test, I just don't have a lot of bandwidth to listen to this kind of disturbance. The truth is that when I look back in human history and I look at the tremendous struggles and challenges that human beings have had to go through, this is like a joke. sitting inside your air-conditioned and heated home, the with the color television on, with your iPad, iPod, Instaface, Skype, whoever it is that you want, whatever it is. Okay, that with a full refrigerator.
Goldhammer once talked about how we needed to get on Twitter. We needed to get on Twitter.
I mean, I guess, yeah, I guess I understand that there's some discomfort, but really, compared to the Romans attacking your town, even quite frankly, to like a major fire that is bearing down on your real estate and your life. This just seems to me to be, I don't know. Maybe if I was in the middle of New York, in the middle of this thing, my anxiety certainly would have been higher, not knowing, what the parameters were likely to be. But now the parameters are now better understood. And I think the rest of us are not living in places where suddenly, we have evidence or indication or fear that humans around us are going to be dying like flies. I live in a state of over 40 million people. Okay? 40 million people, and 1,200 people have died, and another 500 or 600 or so are expected to die. I mean, these are exceedingly small numbers. So a thousand out of a million, that's one in a thousand. A thousand out of 40 million, that's one in 40,000. So my odds of dying this year in an auto accident, folks, are one in 5,000. That's what they are. And they're cumulative over your lifetime. It's one in 5,000 every year. You keep going, you keep going, you keep going. It's about one in 60 lifetime. One in 60? Coronavirus is going to come this year, and then it's going to mitigate. And right now, if you're a Californian, you're staring down the barrel of maybe a 1 in 30,000 chance. You're staring down the barrel of a 1 in 5,000 chance of an auto accident, and it keeps coming back every year for the rest of your life to move it to 1 in 60. So we're talking about a 1 in 60 against a 1 in 30,000. So, yeah, I don't consider this to be something that as a month ago, we didn't know what we had. Now we do. And as Jen has been pointing out, we're being pushed to keep the anxiety rolling for a variety of one of her favorite phrases, which is perverse incentives. And so there's perverse incentives that are keeping essentially reassuring math from reaching us, but it's going to leak out. It's going to be essentially saturating slowly the human consciousness over the next weeks. No problem. Yeah, I'm perfectly patient. It's going to get there, and pretty soon the world's going to figure out that the world didn't end, and we're all going to have a pretty clear vision of this by June. But me, in terms of my reaction to people's psychological upset about what it is that they're facing. It's one thing if you're talking about finances. I remember I had a friend in grad school who said we were out playing golf and we're both psychologists, and he says, I'm listening to this person complain about their issues, and he goes, and I'm thinking to myself, that's nothing compared to what I got going, buddy. I got student loans. I never forgot that. It just cracked me up. If you got financial anxiety about this, that makes a lot of sense to me. Your lives can be derailed, disrupted, changed. I mean, majorly inconvenienced, and it can be a lot of situations can change for the worse as a result of this. But the what else? The social needs or something like this? Or the fact that you're bored or somehow that this is super stressful? I don't know. I don't get it. Maybe Jen can weigh in on this, because my patience for that kind of complaint is very low.
Well, the question actually, the listener actually is saying, It's so true what Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawker said, that it isn't stable people doing the whining. It's people who have a low freak out threshold. And so this person says that they're very bummed about no happy hours, plays, movies, etc. No crowding into state parks and whatnot, but it isn't traumatic. So, The question is, are there any suggestions for talking to these freaked out friends? Should we just let them freak out? It seems like such a, like from my perspective, I look at, how this thing is playing out. It just seems so strange how people are freaking out about this.
Well, actually, Jen, what would you say? If they need anything, they just need better information.
They need better information, but some percentage of the population is beyond information. Some percentage of the population is just kind of, less emotionally stable, going to use a situation like this opportunistically to dodge out of competition. We've talked about this a lot, where it becomes kind of if you've got lower conscientiousness, emotional instability, various other personality factors may come into play here. You're going to see an opportunity in a situation like this, which allows you to exaggerate the amount that you are suffering as a result of it, and therefore present to the Stone Age village that it is not reasonable to expect you to be able to live up to their standards. So that is something that is going to be always present in certain personalities, who are kind of always looking for loopholes and ways to avoid competitive pressures. And when they get this sort of context of a big so-called disaster, big crisis, it becomes very, very expedient to leverage it in self-interest. And so a lot of that is going on. So this is another kind of perverse incentive, where you're going to exaggerate the degree to which something like this is directly affecting your life. So there's lots of that going on. There's also, I think, people... the amount that people are suffering is relative to the degree of comfort that they've been living in. So I very much appreciate what Doug is saying about, it's nothing to, this is not the siege of Leningrad, this is definitely not the kind of situation that humans have collectively endured in the past. But most people who are going through this moment have lived lives of tremendous comfort. There's really not anything in the history of most people, Generation X and younger, apart from a little bit of existential disruption around 9/11 and the end of the Vietnam War. But it's really that, like, this has been a very comfortable, very abundant set of decades for most people alive today. And so people have become accustomed to a very high standard of living, very high degree of safety, very high degree of comfort, cheap, abundant available goods and food and housing and everything else. And so even people who are facing financial disruption, which is, a lot of people are facing some kind of financial disruption, they're not really understanding that even that is, the disruption is sort of correlating Definitely. With their expected level of comfort. And yeah. So, they may have enough money to live at the standard of living that their grandparents did, but not at the standard of living that they're accustomed to and that is comfortable and that is, what they feel entitled to and deserving of. So there's all kinds of swirling stuff going on here where people are using a crisis, misinterpreting a crisis, having the cognitive distortion of projecting it forever out in time without any end, immersing themselves too much in bad information sources from media, social media, participating in a lot of groupthink with similarly freaked out people. I think if you are a stable, well-informed, high IQ person, like all of the people who listen to this fine podcast surely are, then I don't think it's your job to talk people who are freaked out off the ledge. I think you should regard this very similarly to you, like when we talk about the pleasure trap, you know, one of the most common questions we get with healthy living and pleasure trap questions is, oh, how can I convince everyone in my life to eat a whole food plant-based diet like I've suddenly learned about and it's changed my life and it's so great? And it's like, no, you really shouldn't be in the business of trying to convince anyone of anything, for several reasons, but the main reason is that you lording some better position over somebody is a immediate threat to their status. And if people are acting out and freaked out and, you know, claiming on Facebook how traumatized they are and that they can't be possibly expected to go back to work as a result of their trauma, that is a status deficient person who is screaming out to the village for a little bit of recognition of their status deficiency. And so if you come along and you try to talk them out of that, all you're doing is you're threatening a scared animal. And so some people are going to be, you know, they might be in a situation where they really don't know. They really have not encountered the information before. And if they did encounter the information, they would suddenly feel much better about the situation and be able to go forth in their life. But a lot of people are not. A lot of people willfully have ignored the reality of the situation, or you could present them with that data and they would find ways to deny it because they're so... they're just so connected and it's so important to them to leverage the situation in their own interests. So, you look out for yourself, you know, take care of your own informational environment, be a resource for people who would benefit from that resource, but don't get into the business of trying to persuade anybody, convince anybody, soothe anybody. People are just exaggerating and amplifying their baseline personalities in a situation like this.
Wow, absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, fabulous.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, part six of we wanted to talk a little bit more about other things, but coronavirus tends to have dominated the conversation, which I'm totally fine with.
I had a little point on that. It's there was a, you know, when I was on Twitter the other day, somebody actually went and ran, did some sort of keyword analysis on the discussion around coronavirus on Twitter in the last 2 months. And that is also a bell curve. So discussion of it has started to fall off somewhat. People are slowly getting less and less interested, but they're not uninterested. It's still obviously the most common trending topic in basically any venue. So I think it's, as long as it remains predominantly relevant in the lives of people listening, we're going to continue talking about it to some degree. But it is eventually, there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Oh, yeah. No problem for me. I like talking all numbers. I like it that you guys just stick to the truth and nothing but the truth. So help you, I don't know, the moon.
To the flying spaghetti monster.
I think that where I sit today with this is it looks like the models and looks like the evidence tells us that we're on the downslope. And so I'm feeling the relief that appears to be the case. And I expect that a week from now, it will be clearly the case and I'll feel one notch more over comfortable and one notch less interested in talking about coronavirus. And so that's where I see us going. And so just to let people know, we're not going to spin on this indefinitely. And I have a feeling that we are actually right now this week at a very significant turning point in our degree of certainty. So I believe that a week from now, we're going to feel a whole notch freer than we do to be start exploring other things.
I do think, I think you're right about that. But I think that misses the ways in which this will continue to be the most important topic of discussion at a sort of sociological and political level for the next several months as this whole, like I was just talking about a second ago, it continues to be used and interpreted and weaponized by different interest groups that are trying to use it as part of a pre-existing agenda. And that is only, and you're beginning to see the shape of that with the protests in Michigan, with the election in Wisconsin. You know, we're going into the rest of this election season and there's a lot of a lot of landmines built into this, and very different interpretations of reality that are competing for attention and space. And so for me, just sort of as a, you know, social scientist, it remains incredibly interesting sort of intellectually, but also really, really relevant to daily life, because it's not going away anytime soon, even though the numbers are, we can reassure ourselves that, you know, we know what this looks like. We know the rationality of it, but it's going to continue to really directly affect our lives as it, those numbers continue to be misinterpreted and deployed in suboptimal ways.
There you go.
Yeah. And so as Dr. Lyle, the one notch less interested in talking about this. And then as the election gets nearer, Dr. Hawk, I suspect you're going to have one more notch more interested.
Yeah, that's true. We may be in an equilibrium around that, where Doug's like, whatever, the stats are in, I'm done here. And I'm like, hold on. It's just now starting to get interesting, because what's the famous line
about
statistics?
Now it's how people use those numbers. Yeah.
Statistics are lies, and more lies, right, and propaganda. And so that, like, right, never more so than in our current dystopian information environment, where people live in whirlpools of confirmation bias. We're heading into fairly pitched information battles with very high stakes. So, yeah, very interesting to me.
Cool.
Well, for our listeners, if you haven't read The Pleasure Trap already, there's a section in there called Managing the Misinformed and Managing the Irritated when it comes to socializing with people who have completely different ideas of you, and they're trying to push it. And so, Dr. Lyle, I can see how this can correlate to, in the future when people are, you know, staring you down for not wearing the right type of mask in a store, you know what I mean, at midnight or something, that might be a useful chapter for people to read. But
all good. All right, Nathan. Well, terrific. Thanks for your help as always.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Very good. We'll see you then.
Bye.
Gotcha. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.